Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does activity on K Street affect quality of life on Main Street? Even adjusting for inflation, running for office is more expensive today than at any other time in U.S. history. For many congressional lawmakers, fundraising is a weekly activity even outside election season. Most campaigns can't make ends meet without financial support from special interest groups, and that support is nearly always tied to an understanding, formal or not, that a politician will represent the will of those who provide it. These are realities that worry veteran journalist Robert G. Kaiser. He is associate editor and senior correspondent for The Washington Post. His new book is called So Damn Much Money: The Triumph of Lobbying and the Corrosion of American Government. Bob, welcome to Think.
Thanks. Nice to be with you.
Jack Abramoff famously called this legalized bribery. Now, clearly he is a bad example, but he's not the only one who looks at the process this way.
No, he's not. In fact, I was quite taken aback when I heard this description of Abramoff's, and I went around to some very respectable people afterwards and said, what about this? Is this a good description of what's going on? And one who really took me aback was Leon Panetta, who President Obama has now nominated to be the director of the CIA, who said to me, bluntly, legalized bribery is a very good description of what goes on in Washington. It's a very subtle and perverse form of corruption because most of the participants, often all the participants, can say to themselves and to each other, we're not doing anything wrong here. We're just doing what everybody else does, and it's okay. But the truth is, I fear that it has a really corrosive effect on our politics and helps explain why we've had so little creative policymaking for many years on the biggest issues that confront the society, the issues that our new president says he wants to deal with, finally.
Yeah, there's this sense that all of this lobbying activity essentially paralyzes the legislative process.
You know, I think the way to think about it is, in terms of like a good defense in football, the people that have benefited from the government and its programs over the last generation have almost always, without exception, built bulwarks to defend what they've got. And any attempt to reform or improve the general's welfare at their expense, they fight tooth and nail against. A great example every 5 years is the Farm Bill, where this enormous program of subsidies for farmers that costs tens of billions of dollars every year is very difficult to justify as good public policy. It's just good politics. And the farm state legislators whose people benefit the most from the programs are able every time a significant reform is proposed to beat it back. This is just a big and obvious example of something that goes on all the time. Most of lobbying in Washington is playing defense. It's not winning special breaks, although that certainly happens sometimes. But the biggest thing is protecting what you've already got. And after so many years of different groups getting different kinds of benefits and tax breaks and whatever, there's a lot of it there, and it's very hard to change.
So let's talk about how lobbyists get hired and what it is that they can promise their clients.
Well, it's a very good subject, and one of the problems in trying to answer such a question is how varied the world of lobbying can be. The Red Cross has a lobbyist. The teachers have lobbyists. Doctors have lobbyists. And corporate fat cats have lobbyists, and they're not all the same. So that, it very much depends on who you are and what your objective is, what sort of lobbyist you hire, and what you expect from that lobbyist. And it changes in the political atmosphere, too. In 1995, when the Republicans took control of the Congress for the first time in 40-plus years, business lobbyists suddenly found themselves with a degree of friendship and allies, a number of allies in key places in Congress that they hadn't dreamed of before. And that transformed the game. And now the same people are wondering how they're going to stand in a new Washington in which there are no Republicans controlling any branch of government, except arguably the Supreme Court. And they're very nervous, the same people, very concerned what's going to happen to them and their interests. So, to go back to your question, the typical fat cat politically active lobbyist is someone who makes contributions to politicians himself and organizes fundraisers for politicians and is in the business of winning access for powerful and prominent clients. That's the kind of the greasiest kind of lobbying, generally speaking. It's very widespread, but it's by no means the only kind of lobbying.
And we should say that you are not in favor, you don't think that lobbying should be outlawed altogether. You recognize there is a role for this within the system of government that we have.
Yeah, it can't be outlawed. It's protected in the Constitution. The First Amendment, which you and I like because it protects us in our professional lives, also protects the rights of all citizens to petition the government for redress of grievances. Well, that's a fancy way of saying lobbying. The lobbyist's art is surely an expression of democratic values, that people should be allowed to express their desires and their complaints to the people that have power over them in the government. There's no way to do away with that.
So I know that there are some new rules as of 2007 that govern exactly what lobbyists can give to lawmakers and how they have to record those gifts. But can you talk about basically what a lobbyist does in order to gain particular access or favor with a lawmaker?
Another very good question. And again, there's a multitude of answers. But the lobbyist will say that the best thing I can provide to a member is information. And that's often true, but the definition of what constitutes information can be interesting. One of the best tools for a good lobbyist is the ability to explain to a member whose support he or she needs for some particular client or some particular legislative proposal, how that will be good for the political situation of the member. In other words, Congressman, you may not realize that in your district there are X number of people that belong to my organization, but they're very fervently interested in this issue, and you better get on board with them or they're going to be against you in the next election, things of that kind. That kind of political salesmanship is terribly important. The other obvious thing that's common to everyday practice in Washington is to raise money and to provide other forms of concrete, tangible political support to a member.
Let's talk about this money issue, because I was really startled to see that for the average Washington lawmaker, about a day a week can be spent just on fundraising if you total up all the hours over the course of a year.
It often is really a day a week. I mean, many members set aside one day a week to do fundraising. They make phone calls dialing for dollars. It's a really demeaning, I think, and kind of depressing to imagine these people that, you know, think very highly of themselves. I'm a senator. I'm a member of the House of Representatives. And yet there they are, forlornly, making these phone calls. And one of the most interesting characters in my book is a professional paid fundraising consultant, a guy named Mike Fraioli, who shared his business life with me in an engaging way. And Mike told me about, you know, what you do. You give a member a list of 100 people that have given to candidates whose positions are similar to his, or who have some reason, they have some reason to think might be a willing donor. And the member has to dial the call himself, herself, introduce herself, say, you know, I'm running for election again 2 years or next year, whatever. I need your help. I'm hoping you can give me some money. It's just a kind of, you know, self-denigrating behavior that it seems to me awfully discouraging. I'd hate to have to try to do it myself.
And obviously it is not cheap to hire a guy like Mike Fraioli to begin with.
No. The expenses throughout the system now are really huge, so that the costs of these campaigns have gone through the roof. And there's this whole class of characters, the campaign consultants, the people that make TV commercials for politicians, the pollsters who take polls to find out what people want to hear from the politicians so they can help shape the message, and these campaign finance consultants who are helping raise the money. You know, all of them cost big bucks.
Robert G. Kaiser is my guest. He is senior correspondent and associate editor for The Washington Post. His new book is called So Damn Much Money, The Triumph of Lobbying and the Corrosion of American Government.
I should tell you, if I may interrupt, that the title of the book came from Dallas indirectly. It came from your Bob Strauss, one of Washington's most successful lobbyists over many years and an old acquaintance of mine. And I went to interview him about this project. I said, Strauss, explain to me why has lobbying boomed so in the years that you've been in it? And he thought about it for a moment. He said, you know, there's just so damn much money in it.
Yeah, you write, there are a lot of lobbyists who have clients that are paying them, individual clients, $40,000 a month.
Yes. That would be a corporation, not a person. But mm-hmm. Yes, that's not unusual.
And that's above and beyond whatever it is that the lobbyist might that the hiring agency would provide to any lawmakers.
Sure, but you know it's now standard for big American corporations to have a political action committee that solicits money from its own executives and they put it into a pot and it's called a PAC, a PAC, and the PAC makes contributions to candidates who support the corporation and hopes to cultivate. So that would be in addition to the big fees paid to lobbyists. And, you know, one of the things I realized after talking to lots of the participants in this crazy system is that if you're say, American Airlines, to pick a big Dallas corporation as an example, American Airlines has dozens of lobbyists, not all making $40,000 a month, but if you added up the total tab, it would be millions of dollars a year that American Airlines is spending on lobbyists in Washington.
So ultimately, this is also something we pay for as consumers.
Of course. Mm-hmm. But if you asked the president of American Airlines, why are you spending all this money? He'd say, well, you know, it isn't all that much when you consider how important the government is to our business. For example, you've got that famous Love Field business down there. Do you know about that?
Yes, we can't stop talking about that.
Right. Well, you know, that's a situation in which the federal government is arbitrarily allocating big economic benefits to airlines, which is a natural target for lobbying. So I know several big-time Washington lobbyists who have been retained by Southwest and American to fight over who gets the landing slots at Love Field. That's just big money. But obviously those slots are worth a lot to the airlines involved.
You have been reporting on politics since the early 60s. Can you talk about when you first really noticed a change in the way money impacted the process?
The late 70s, I think, mm-hmm. is the first time, the 78 election probably, which I write about in the book. It was peanuts compared to what happened afterwards. But it's the rise of television really makes the big difference. One of the things that politicians discovered in the course of the 70s and early 80s was how effective TV advertising could be as a political tool. Most of the people that were in office in the 70s and early 80s had been born and before television, you know, and hadn't fully absorbed television for all the power it was having in society. And these clever commercial makers came along and said, listen, we can poll your district. We can find out what's on people's minds, what they're worried about, what they're hoping for. Then we'll make some commercials that appeal directly to those concerns. And it'll be boffo. You'll be great. You'll be reelected easily. And so they do this, and lo and behold, it worked. And the success of it fed it so that everybody soon was on board. Even a lot of people who were extremely uncomfortable doing it. They had to do it because if they didn't, their opponent would and they'd be out of office.
Robert G. Kaiser is my guest. We're talking about his new book, So Damn Much Money, The Triumph of Lobbying and the Corrosion of American Government. We'll return to the conversation in a moment and welcome you to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses beginning in January. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is senior correspondent and associate editor for The Washington Post, Robert G. Kaiser. His new book is called So Damn Much Money, The Triumph of Lobbying at the Corrosion of American Government. You can join us by emailing think at kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Bob, you alluded to this earlier, the fact that the Constitution allows for lobbying. We should also point out the fact that not only is this not a new phenomenon, it's not even a uniquely American phenomenon in its origins.
No, you're absolutely right. It's the origins of petitioning the government go back to 11th century England, 1100s, 12th century England. And you know, many other governments now have lobbying. They can't avoid it. There's no way to tell interest groups and citizens that they can't make known their views. So it comes along with democratic government wherever it shows up, I think.
Is the American way of doing things now being copied elsewhere in the world?
I fear it is. You know, and it began, interestingly, with the political consultants. There's many elections in foreign countries have featured expert advice by TV commercial makers, pollsters, and consultants from the United States. Boris Yeltsin in Russia had American political consultants. All the major parties in Israel have American political consultants. Both the major parties in Britain do, too. And from that has grown, unfortunately, for those countries, versions of our influence-peddling culture, which I'm not sure I admire, but they've sure got them.
You focus in the book on a guy named Jerry Cassidy and his company. Some of what you learned about him initially came because he decided to take it all public, meaning he had to file details of the business model with the SEC. And, of course, that makes them publicly available. Can you talk about what you learned from those documents that made you think, there is a book here?
Yes. A writer with a complicated subject is always looking for a way to make the story come alive and to avoid writing dense pages of facts and figures and generalizations. And I, from the beginning of my interest in this subject, I was looking for one human being who I could use as a kind of vehicle to explain what lobbying really was, how it actually worked, why it was successful, et cetera, et cetera. And as you just said, I discovered, or a colleague of mine at the Post actually pointed out to me, that Cassidy had once attempted to take his little lobbying firm public by selling shares on a stock exchange. That requires, as you said, the filing of something called an S-1, a very detailed statement of how your company works and why it makes money and why anybody would want to be a stockholder in it. And Cassidy did that. And it was the first time a Washington lobbying firm had taken this step. It was the early 90s. And the document was just fascinating because it did explain many of the details of how the firm did business, how it hired its own staff, what kind of people it was looking for, how it cultivated new clients, how it got business. It was really a roadmap. So when I found this, I was thrilled and delighted. And then I went to see Mr. Cassidy and I said, "Bad luck," I said. I've come to pick on you. I'm going to make an example of you, and I'm going to learn everything I possibly can about you and your business, and I'm going to write a book about it.
He was not initially thrilled and delighted, but he sort of came around and worked with you.
He did, and I'm grateful to him for that, and very pleased too, because thanks to his very extensive cooperation and long hours of recorded interviews, many, many hours of interviews, I'm able to, I think, create for readers a real understanding of the kind of person this is and how he does his business and how he got rich. And he's really rich. He's got a fortune now of at least $100 million.
And money is important enough to him that at least for a short time, he was actively recruiting Jack Abramoff.
Yes, that's the book begins with that mistake that he made. It's interesting. Cassidy was a liberal Democrat. He came to Washington to work for George McGovern. He was a young lawyer who had been working on a legal aid project in Florida, defending migrant workers in the Florida garden patch over there near Naples, where they grow tomatoes and cantaloupes and so on. And he was a kind of bleeding heart liberal, and governor was then chairman of something called the Senate Select Committee on Nutrition and Human Needs, which came down to Florida and held hearings on the terrible conditions that these migrant workers lived in. And Cassidy met McGovern and his staff, and they got the idea that he'd like to come to Washington and work for McGovern. And indeed, he was able to talk his way into a job, and he did that. And that's the beginning of his Washington life. Abramoff was a product of the Reagan conservative Republican movement, somebody from a completely different world than Cassidy's. It's hard to think of somebody like Jerry Cassidy being naive, but to some degree he was naive about what Abramoff had done and how he had done it. And Abramoff was fired very unceremoniously by his last law firm when it discovered some of what he'd been up to that it disapproved of. And right after that, Jerry Cassidy offered Abramoff a job. He quickly regretted it and backed out of the deal. But it's an interesting example of the way, once you get swept up in this world, and Cassidy was very swept up in it because at that moment his lobbying firm, which had long been top-ranked in Washington for the amount of money he was making, had slipped into second place, which I think drove Jerry Cassidy crazy. He didn't like being in second place. And I think he was tempted by Abramoff in large measure because he hoped Abramoff would bring large new business to the firm and put it back in first place.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Robert G. Kaiser is my guest. The new book is called So Damn Much Money. Let us speak to Tom in Dallas. Hello, Tom.
Hey, good afternoon, Chris. Mr. Kaiser, Ralph Nader has been writing and lecturing about this for the last 25 or 30 years, and yet the Commission on Presidential Debates tried to get him arrested in St. Louis at Washington University during the debate in 2000, and at the University of Massachusetts in Boston, the state police threatened to arrest him for being in the parking lot of where the debates were going on, and he's devoted his entire life given back to the community, which is almost 50 years. And yet, you know, a man of his stature is ignored, not let on the ballot in five states and not let on the presidential debate of any year that he's won. And this is the reason that he is running, is to expose this corporate corruption, including the news media.
Well, Tom, I I hear you. I don't think he's gotten into those scrapes because he's spoken out against the corruption. I think, you know, it's more complicated than that, as I'm sure you know. But I hear you. I know. I've known Ralph for 45 years, I think. He and I actually have the same dentist in Washington, and we were both in there a couple of weeks ago. Ralph is an acquired taste. He's never been entirely my cup of tea, but he's a very productive, interesting character, and certainly he's done a lot to bring things to light that would not have been brought to light without him, going way back to his fights with General Motors in the 60s. But there are a lot of good people in Washington have been talking about the problems of money and lobbying and corruption here for a long time. Obama is the first president we've had, really, ever, to take this stuff seriously. It's going to be interesting to see what he can do about it.
What if you talk for a minute about the kinds of rules that exist to control how lobbyists are able to recruit from within the ranks of elected officials who may be leaving office, and particularly their staff members?
Well, this is a good subject because it's changing. Until early 2007, the revolving doors spun merrily away, bringing people out of the government into lobbying and out of lobbying back into the government. But after the Abramoff scandal, and after the Democrats won control of Congress in the 2006 elections, the Democrats in both houses decided that they had to impose new rules. Interestingly, and this is something I write about in the book, I won't go into the detail now, but interestingly, the House and Senate came to different conclusions about what to do, but both tightened the rules a lot on gifts. No member of Congress, House or Senate, can accept anything now from a lobbyist. That's a huge change from 15, 20 years ago or 10 years ago, when they routinely were wined and dined and given seats to sporting events and things like that by lobbyists. And that's a healthy change. And on the question you raised about who can go to lobby and what are the rules, we now have the funny situation where a House member who goes into lobbying has to wait 1 year before talking to any member of the House, in other words, any former colleague, on behalf of a client. But in the Senate, the rule is 2 years. So somebody leaving the Senate now becoming a lobbyist, I think, is less appealing to a lobbying firm or a client, because 2 years is a long time to wait.
It's enough time to be out of the loop, essentially.
Exactly, and to have your contacts go a little bit cold and so on. Now, yesterday, President Obama issued an executive order affecting political appointees to his administration, which goes much farther. And we should say, but I'll explain that in a moment, but it should be understood first that we have thousands of former government officials working today as registered lobbyists in Washington, several thousand. But only a couple of hundred of those are former members of Congress. Most of them are former officials from the executive branch. So Obama's proposal says, if you're appointed to my administration, you must sign a commitment that you will not try to lobby my administration if you leave it and go back into private practice or somehow become a lobbyist after working for me. You will not be allowed to lobby my administration for as long as it exists. In other words, for as much as 8 years if he's elected to a second term. Now, that's a big change. That will really close the revolving door for people at that level from the executive branch. And I consider that a very healthy first step for a reform-minded president to take.
The president has specifically not ruled out extending ambassadorships to friends of the campaign and other sorts of positions of that kind. But that's a practice that you think also needs to be prohibited.
Ambassadorships have become so corrupted. It started with Bill Clinton, really. Well, it started with Richard Nixon, but it got out of control with Clinton and then with Bush, where you had obviously, patently unqualified people serving as our ambassadors in very important big countries, only because they were personal friends and big donors for the president. And that's just wrong, in my opinion. Obama's position on this so far is unclear. And I think it's an important test to see. There's nothing wrong with political appointees as ambassadors if they're qualified to serve in the job. But let's see what kind of people he picks and whether he picks big donors. We just don't know yet.
Robert G. Kaiser is my guest. His new book is called So Damn Much Money. You can join us on the phone at 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak to Larray in Dallas. Hey, Larray.
Hi. This is a great and timely show. I would like to ask the guest to comment on something. I think that we're all on board with what lobbyists get out of this arrangement. And I'd like to take it further and say, if politicians are in this maniacal drive to raise money all the time, how does that money translate into political power? Does that place them on more powerful committees, et cetera? Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Good questions. It really got bad in the early years of this century, I think. On the Republican side in the House, Tom DeLay and Dennis Hastert, the leaders of the House, developed a policy of rewarding their colleagues who raised the most money with the chairmanships of the big committees. So it literally became true that the chairman of the Appropriations Committee was chosen in large measure because he was the most successful fundraiser. And that's a kind of ugly answer to Lorraine's question, which the Democrats have not embraced this approach, although they discussed it, interestingly, when they won control back in 2006. But they're still making chairman mostly on the basis of seniority. Not going that far. But I do think that members who can raise a lot of money for their colleagues inevitably win the friendship, support, and respect of those colleagues, and that's a real factor. The other aspect of the question is, do the donors who have special interests get special treatment as a result of their donations? This is, of course, an extremely gray area. It's very hard to know exactly why members do certain things. I know members of Congress personally who try very hard to diversify their sources of contributions so that no particular contributor can say, well, I've really got a hook into Congressman Jones because I've given him $100,000, whatever it is, which incidentally, under the latest rules, is hard to do. You can't make such big contributions anymore as you used to be able to do in the era of soft money, which was ended by the McCain-Feingold Act. If the money wasn't useful, I think it's a reasonable conclusion to draw. People wouldn't give it. Obviously, there's some people who give money to campaigns just out of political enthusiasm or loyalty or whatever. But these big corporate interests, corporate PACs, and big Washington lobbyists who give lots and lots of money to politicians are not doing it, as one of them said to me, who I quoted in the book, we're not doing this to promote good government. They're doing it to win friends and influence people and to get access to the powerful, which is a big part of the lobbying game.
I mean, we know that if you're lobbying, you have a particular position on something. How accurate is the information that that lobbyists tend to provide to lawmakers? Are some known to be very, very honest, at least about the information they give, and are some more likely to sort of bend their interpretation of reality?
It's an interesting situation because if you're a lobbyist, you're almost inevitably worried about ongoing relationships. You're not just visiting this congressman or this senator today for this particular client that you have right now, but you want to be able to come back next week and see him on another matter for a different client and next year and so on. So there's a very powerful incentive, and I think it's quite effective, to convince lobbyists to be truthful and to provide good information, because if you become known as someone who bends the truth, you're not going to be welcome in that member's office, and ultimately you're not going to get much done.
Back in just a moment with Robert G. Kaiser. He is associate editor and senior correspondent for The Washington Post. His new book is called So Damn Much Money, The Triumph of Lobbying and the Corrosion of American Government. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses beginning in January. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Washington Post senior correspondent Robert G. Kaiser. His new book is called So Damn Much Money, The Triumph of Lobbying and the Corrosion of American Government. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. So, Bob, we know that there are limits on how much money and the kinds of gifts that lawmakers can take from lobbyists. I'm wondering, though, if elected officials tend to use the apparent wealth of a particular lobbying firm or individual as a tool for evaluating the legitimacy of one particular special interest over another.
I doubt it, but I'm not sure. It's wealth makes an impression. It's interesting that Jerry Cassidy, who we talked about a few minutes ago, the central figure in my book, in a way, when he got successful, he spent a great deal of money creating an office environment in Washington, which, when you're in his place, you feel like you're in the offices of very fancy Wall Street lawyers, I think, furnished with very fancy antiques. He's got a copy of a Gilbert Stuart painting of George Washington on the wall in his office, and a lot of beautiful furnishings and carpets in there. It's all, I think, mostly, however, not to impress members of Congress. It's to impress potential clients. This is somebody who obviously knows what he's doing and ought to be taken seriously. I don't think members of Congress, their evaluations, I should say, are of the legitimacy of a particular pleading is, I think, are based mostly on politics, not on money. In other words, is there a political benefit to be gained, And money can, of course, be a political benefit in the sense of fundraising for campaigns. But it's not evaluating the past accumulated wealth of a particular lobbyist. I don't think that would be a big factor.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Louisville and speak with Brett. Hey, Brett.
Hey, how you doing?
Great, thank you.
Great show. I just had a quick question. I'm wondering what you feel the influence of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party have on that, on lobbying. And additionally, if politicians should have to state their stance on anything before they're elected, or not, you know, have like a broad-based questionnaire that they could, would have to answer for if they change their stand on key issues instead of being affiliated with a party directly. That's it. I would appreciate your comment.
To answer in reverse order, on the second point, there are now many, many organizations that send questionnaires to candidates and ask them for their positions on all kinds of different matters. And I think that's a healthy thing. I don't think we could impose some kind of national standard for questionnaire because it would be so difficult to agree on what the questions ought to be. But you can find yourself as a voter often from interest groups that try to do this, you can find out a lot about candidates' positions.
Well, it is interesting that it is interest groups typically that maintain these lists.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Of course. Now, on the parties, however, are very important now in fundraising, and that's something worth mentioning here briefly. One of the reasons that the Democrats did so well in the last two congressional elections, 06 and 08, the main reason, I think, is the failure of the Bush administration, the unpopularity of its policies. But beyond that, Democrats had huge amounts of money, big advantages over Republicans for the first time in a long time in these two cycles. And it certainly showed, particularly in the Senate races this year, that the National Democratic Senate Campaign Committee had several times more money than the Republican Committee and was able to give its candidates a lot of extra dough.
We have a question here via email that asks that you talk about the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee and its influence on foreign policy. I don't remember it specifically in the book, but perhaps you're familiar with it.
No, I didn't get into that in the book. I've written about it in the paper before. AIPAC is the acronym for that outfit, and it is one of the most formidable pro-Israel lobbying organizations in town. And it's been enormously influential over the years, and it has persuaded politicians, I think sometimes persuaded them more effectively than the facts would justify, to accept it as a spokesman for American friends of Israel, supporters of Israel. In fact, American friends of Israel, particularly Jewish ones, are, I think, sharply divided about Israeli politics, and AIPAC has been pretty well lined up in recent years behind the conservative factions in Israel. And the hawkish factions, but it's a very powerful lobby. It does involve money. The Jewish groups raise a lot of money for politicians, but it's more than money. There's a lot of political maneuvering and alliance building and so on. For example, AIPAC has been responsible for building alliances with many of the Christian conservative organizations that are also staunch supporters of Israel. It's a big player.
When you talk about alliances, I'm thinking here about those that are much more personal and individual in nature. Obviously, there are people who will enter the lobby after having worked as government staffers just very soon after having left, whether or not there's a one-year or a two-year delay. And a lot of them will say, well, look, I have to do this. I didn't make very much in my government job on a staff somewhere, and therefore this is sort of my reward for having toughed it out there. This may seem like a ridiculous question to some people, but would it make sense to consider paying those staffers more money so that they don't absolutely have to jump into the lobby in order to pay off their student loans?
You know, how much is enough is one of the great questions in Washington. It's never really answerable. I don't know. Newspaper men are not all that well paid either, so when a staff director of a House committee who makes $165,000 a year says, I've got to go lobby because I'm not making enough.
Yeah, it's hard to be sympathetic.
It's a little hard to be sympathetic. And yet, in Washington terms, and this is one of the things I write about in the book, is the way Washington has changed. In fact, there's a wonderful quotation from Jerry Cassidy himself in the book toward the end. I won't pause to try to find it, but it's a really good quote where Cassidy says, you know, when I first came to Washington, which is the late 60s, the public civil servants were held in a very high regard, and they lived a good life. They had nice houses and good neighborhoods, and people looked up to them. They had respect. All that's gone now, he says. All that's gone. Well, it is gone, and it's not gone because the civil servant's salary has collapsed. It hasn't. It's continued. It's kept up with inflation. The top civil servants who make the same as the top as the members of Congress, which is about 165,000 now, you know, that puts them right in the top 5 or 6% of incomes in America. But if you're living in a community where lots of people earn $1 million a year and $500,000 a year and $800,000 a year, which are typical salaries for big-time lobbyists, then you feel a lot poorer than if you live in a small town in America where the average family didn't make anything like that. And that's a big factor here now. So I think, you know, you asked your question in a nice way as though you were crediting the excuse given by this person. I had to do it to pay off my student loans. Well,
you heard maybe that more than once, though, didn't you?
But you know, I think most of them do it because they want to live like kings, and they, you know, they see former colleagues of theirs who used to struggle with them on the Capitol Hill salary, and now suddenly with two Mercedes and a big country house and a big house in the city, and they say, "Geez, I'd like to have that too." I think that's a much more effective inducement, probably.
And does that ultimately sort of kill the passion of those lobbyists? I mean, there must be some who enter. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of cynical people in this game. And it's interesting to, you know, you get to know them. I mean, you and I are lucky. Nobody tells us what to think or how to do our jobs. And it's a pretty luxurious intellectual life that we in the media, particularly the ones working for good organizations, have. But some of these poor men and women are, you know, working for slimy clients and doing unappealing things and making huge amounts of money to do so. And I think it breeds cynicism in many people.
It makes you think, I mean, I'd rather not have the money.
No, I agree.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Bob in Dallas. Hello, Bob.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just wondering about the insurance lobby and how it's really hurting the people who are kind of at the bottom, like injured workers and the like.
Well, the insurance lobby is one of many successful big business lobbies that have indeed had a lot of success in Congress. I'm not sure what specifically you're referring to, but one of the stories that I like is about the bankruptcy law, which this was not insurance, this was bankers and credit card companies. But you all know, I'm sure, that a few years ago, it suddenly became much harder to declare personal bankruptcy.
Even if you've had a job loss and even if you have medical problems.
Exactly. And Jerry Cassidy himself says to me, it's in the book, this is one of the worst changes in the law I've seen in all the years I've been in Washington. He was really against it, personally. And yet it sailed right through. It had lots of votes from Democrats and Republicans alike. Some of these lobbies are just so effective. I'm trying to think quickly of an insurance example. There's not one jumping into my mind. But the other famous one recently was the drug industry. The drug industry, literally, lobbyists for the drug companies wrote the legislation that created the Medicare drug benefit. And they wrote it in a way that has maximally benefited drug companies. And, you know, it's kind of scandalous in a way, but nobody gets called on it. There it is. It just happens.
Let's go next to Mike in Dallas. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I had a very interesting experience. I was a legislative representative for a nonprofit for 3 sessions of the state legislature. And my job primarily was to, since we were not a well-known group, to in fact, educate legislators regarding why a bill should be killed. The thrust seems to me in the whole lobby industry is not passing legislation, but killing it. And the other thing I noticed is a legislative body, when it gets together, is a totally unreal animal. It's it's easy to become cynical real quickly, which is why I declined an invitation to become professional. But I'd just like to hear your guests comment on that aspect of the lobby business.
Yeah, thanks for your call, Mike. Bob, it sounds like you can probably relate to the unreal nature of a legislative body.
Well, for sure. I mean, one of the tragedies to me of the modern era, the last 20, 30 years, has been the decline of concern for reality. The era of what I call the permanent campaign, where candidates, office holders are constantly worrying about how is something I say today going to be used against me in my next campaign? What are they going to turn into a negative TV commercial that's going to clobber me and so on? You have people that, because of those pressures, posturing and taking positions, not because they think it's the best position or the correct position, but just because it's the one that's politically easily defended, most easily defended. And there have been very few really serious debates on really big issues, global warming, energy use, the retirement of the baby boomers and how we're going to pay for it. I mean, these are huge things, and all of us know in our bones that they're important and that the government ought to be helping us deal with them. And yet, for many, many years now, the government agencies and the elected representatives in Congress have run away from all those tough issues, knowing that any time we really do something about them, we're going to make a lot of enemies. Why make enemies is the kind of the reigning point of view here in Washington. So things just don't get done. Problems don't get addressed. You know, this is a recurring theme in Obama's rhetoric, and he promises now, beginning with his inaugural address, we're going to do it. We're going to confront these things. Well, let's see if he can. It's not going to be easy.
So here you are, Bob, plugging away not just with the book, but certainly with your writing for The Washington Post. Do you see a rising level of public vigilance on this issue, and will that ultimately make enough of a difference to really clean up the system?
Well, yes to your first question. There's no question there's a much higher level of public involvement and people paying attention than there was 5, 10, 15 years ago. The 80s and the 90s were a weird interlude in American life for me. I've written about this in a different book. I won't go into it here. But we were really out to lunch for 20 years. We were just enjoying life and getting rich. And it was a different time. Does the Obama movement herald a new kind of citizenship, a new attention? Will it lead to a really different kind of politics? I just don't know. I'm intrigued to watch and find out.
Bob Kaiser, thank you so much for being with us. He is associate editor and senior correspondent for The Washington Post. The new book is called So Damn Much Money. Bob, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
This was fun. Thanks, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.